This is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. The author Jonathan Raban passed away last week. Though born in England, he made Seattle his home after moving here in 1990. And even after decades in the city, he still says he felt like an outsider.
I'm deeply conscious of being and remaining English. And of this place being, for me, a foreign country. I mean, it is surprising to be in a supermarket every so often and hearing voices and thinking, why are all these people talking in their accent? I feel myself to be a stranger here.
Still?
Oh, yes.
That was Jonathan Raban speaking to KUOW's Marcy Silman in 2013. He passed away last week at 80. Raban used that distance to explore and write about other immigrants to the Western U.S. Jonathan Raban also wrote about trips through Alaska's Inside Passage and told the story of duped farmers in eastern Montana, all with insightful prose that illuminated the complexity of everyday life. Christopher Frizzell joins me now to talk about the Jonathan Raban he knew. Frizzell is the founder of Frizz Lit, and he's also the former editor-in-chief of The Stranger, where he sometimes edited Raban. He started out our conversation by talking to me about who Jonathan Raban was as a writer and a person.
Jonathan lived a life of the mind, but his mind was always on the move. He was cerebral. He was sardonic. He was intimidatingly well-read, both on the page and in person. I was in constant awe of Jonathan's wit, his quickness, his mercilessness, and his sense of adventure. He was particularly brilliant at the intersection of literary criticism and global politics. Obituaries keep calling him a travel writer, but that might be misleading. He didn't write about hotels and restaurants. He went on adventures to Arabia, for example, or floating down the Mississippi River, or sailing by himself to Alaska. And he used those adventures as an excuse to write about life's biggest subjects.
You took a trip with Jonathan Raban to North Bend for a profile in The Stranger. What do you remember about that trip?
Gosh, I remember him pulling up to my apartment building in a convertible with the top down, and it seemed so unlike him. It didn't quite compute for me. He drove really fast. He was hilarious. He was really interested. He was writing a piece, I think, for The Guardian at the time, about politics in King County beyond the city. And he was really interested in how rural people, especially, looked at policy and politics. I remember we went to a diner in North Bend, and there was a woman with a camo purse and gigantic hair, full of hairspray, walking through the parking lot. And it was just so unlike any kind of figure that I'd seen in Jonathan's work before that we had a funny moment saying, like, gosh, aren't we in the craziest place? And I said something like, I just love being in a weird situation where I'm super uncomfortable. And he said, I do too. And you can tell in his writing. His writing was very much about being an outsider, being uncomfortable, not knowing how things fit together, and exploring that.
Is there any work by Jonathan Raban that you think best exemplifies who he was as a writer? And what would that be?
You know, there's two that come to mind. I think for pure enjoyment, the book that I love is Hunting Mr. Heartbreak. It's about being an outsider coming to the United States from England in the late 1980s. There's nothing like an outsider's gaze to really help you see something fresh. Being an outsider gave him this total freedom because he wasn't beholden to anyone. In that book, he visits a variety of places. He visits New York City. He visits Key West. He visits Alabama. But there's something about Seattle that calls to him. He writes in that book, it was something in the disposition of the landscape, the shifting lights and colors of the city. Something. It was hard to nail it, but this something was a mysterious gift that Seattle made to every immigrant who cared to see it. Wherever you came from, Seattle was queerly like home. He goes on to say, it was an extraordinarily soft and pliant city. people who came to Seattle could somehow recast it in the image of home, arranging the city around themselves like so many pillows on a bed. One day you'd wake up to find things so snug and familiar that you could easily believe you'd been born here. You know, he lived on Queen Anne Hill in a house that he pointed out to me resembled the inside of a boat. And in a way, even from the corner of that book-lined room where he wrote, he was always at sea in the most expansive sense. He could go anywhere and explore anything. And when he didn't know something, when he was searching for something, that's when his writing was most alive. I probably agree with people who say that his masterpiece is Passage to Juno. If Hunting Mr. Heartbreak is an entertaining look at the United States from the eyes of an outsider, Passage to Juno is a book about life and death. It's a book about sailing to Alaska by himself, and halfway through the trip, he's stopped in a port city and he's on a phone call and he learns that his father is dying. So he has to stop his trip and go be with his father and attend his father's funeral. And then after that, he gets back on the boat and continues the trip, this time in conversation with his father's ghost. I'd love to read you a little bit from the beginning of Passage to Juno, if you'd let me.
Yes, please. Thank you.
At the beginning of Passage to Juno, he writes about how his sailboat was central to his life as a working writer. Here he is describing that sailboat. Quote, "It had deteriorated into a comfortably down-at-heel floating cottage, cluttered with books and pictures, box files, two manual typewriters, furry animals, my daughter's contribution, wine, photographic stuff, hurling manuscripts, dead ballpoint pens, and all the rest of the impedimenta of a singularly untidy writer's life." He says that when a concentrated bout of reading was called for, or a chapter needed writing, or when my furies dogged me to distraction, I'd take off for the nearby scribble of islands and let go the anchor. With the floor sashaying underfoot, the chain grumbling on the sea bottom, and the view from the boat's windows revolving slowly on the tide, I found the equilibrium that I was prone to lose on the unstable land. The creaks and groans, the smell of paraffin and diesel were conducive to thinking and remembering. Afloat, the boat was an unplace, a bubble world, off at a useful tangent to the insistent here and now of the American coastline. Cramped, dark, and coffin-like, it was my yada, my asylum, my ark. Just beautiful writing.
What was it like to edit him? You edited some of Rabin's work when he would occasionally write for The Stranger.
Yeah. So I first met him in 2003 or 2004 when I was in my early 20s, and I was working as a book critic at The Stranger. And we had many long conversations about his work, sometimes over red wine in his house on Queen Anne Hill. In 2006, The Stranger awarded him a Genius Award for his work, and I got to write the profile of him, which is how I ended up in that convertible with him driving to North Bend. Later, I became editor-in-chief of The Stranger, and when he was writing something that he thought The Stranger might be interested in, he'd send it my way. Spoiler alert, it always interested me. He would turn in drafts that could make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. I remember feeling that way when he turned in a piece about Joseph Conrad and the 9/11 hijackers. Like I said, he was particularly brilliant at the intersection of literary criticism and global politics.
Yeah, I was just reading the piece he wrote about Sandra Day O'Connor's warning about America's slide into authoritarianism and kind of his outrage at why that wasn't a bigger story, that she was, this former Supreme Court justice was, you know, declaring that that was a risk. And yeah, he's bringing in so many threads and pulling things from, his experience and his observations of the present day and the evocative writing.
But he was so ahead of his time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I believe that Sandra Day O'Connor piece, I can't remember the date, but I think that was before the Trump era. I mean,
He
was onto this issue of creeping authoritarianism long before anyone else was talking about it.
Yeah, it was 2006. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. He was also writing about red state and blue state long before anybody else was. I mean, he was really ahead of his time.
Christopher Frizzell is the founder of Frizz Lit. He's also the former editor-in-chief of The Stranger. You can check out his upcoming events, including the silent reading party, at frizzlit.com. Thank you so much, Christopher.
Thank you for having me.
And Jonathan Rabin's memoir, Father and Son, is due out this fall. Thanks for listening to Soundside. Don't forget you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org or on your favorite podcast app.